Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, January 11th, 2026. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on snowbirds from Canada. Then we'll move on to a second top story on a textbook in Arizona education. And then we'll move on to Valley and State news and conclude the first hour with articles in world and national news from USA Today. Our first article is a feature front page article for today entitled Snowbirds Not Headed South. The subtitle is How a Seismic Shift in Canadian Travel Impacts Arizona. This is by Michael Salerno. Huguette Martel enjoyed the mild Arizona winters and traveling to national parks with her camper. But the newly retired Quebec City, Canada resident doesn't plan to return this year, citing the political climate in the U.S. Instead, she plans to visit the French Antilles and explore parts of her country she hasn't visited yet, like Newfoundland, Labrador, and northern Quebec. I'm making this choice in solidarity with all Canadians who will lose their jobs due to tariffs and the betrayal of the American administration by their failure to comply with the free trade agreement, Martel said, her response translated from French. She's just one of a growing number of Canadians who plan to break their traditions of traveling south to Sunbelt states like Arizona to flee the freezing winters of their homeland. A study from the market research firm Longwoods International found about 80% of Canadians who canceled plans to visit the U.S. cited tariffs and economic policies as a factor in changing their plans. Another 71% cited political statements from U.S. leaders. In response, several airlines with flights between the U.S. and Canada said they're reviewing their routes and adjusting for demand. One airline, ultra-low-cost Flair Airlines, suspended seasonal flights to Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport after ending its winter season earlier than scheduled, ending Calgary and Edmonton flights on April 8th and ending Vancouver flights on April 22nd. Demand for U.S. travel is in decline as Canadians feel unwelcome. About 20.4 million Canadians visited the U.S. in 2024. Responsible for $20.5 billion in spending that supports 140,000 American jobs, according to the U.S. Travel Association. The association found Canadian travel to the U.S. during the first 6 months of 2025 dropped by almost 20%. The number of Canadians returning from travel to the U.S. via automobile declined sharply from January to August 2025, down almost 33% from the same period in 2024, according to Statistics Canada. Fewer Canadians also returned from the U.S. by air, down 17% in the first 8 months of 2025. Experts attribute the declining demand for Canadian tourist visits to the U.S. in part to Canadian travelers' negative sentiment of President Donald Trump's tariffs on Canadian goods and his calls to annex Canada as the 51st state. Sliding demand also coincided with heightened scrutiny at the border and Canada issuing new advisories to its citizens about U.S. travel. This spring, the Trump administration introduced new requirements for Canadians visiting the U.S. longer than 30 days to register with immigration authorities. And on October 1st, Canada warned LGBTQ+ travelers with a gender-neutral X identifier on their passports that they may face entry restrictions or be asked to provide sex or gender information identifying as male or female when traveling in the U.S. Some Canadians are also canceling their U.S. travel plans because the Canadian dollar is weak against the U.S. dollar, making it difficult for Canadians to afford a U.S. visit, said Miles Zimbaluk, CEO of Canada to USA, a company that offers cross-border services for Canadians traveling to the U.S., including Arizona. Longwoods International found about 45% of Canadians who canceled plans to travel to the U.S. canceled because of the weak Canadian dollar. The trade war, Trump's rhetoric, and the weak Canadian dollar have made Canadians feel unwelcome in the U.S., said Simbaluk, whose company works with Canadians who plan to travel to or buy homes in Arizona. Canada is a proud country, Zimbaluk said. I don't think they like the tone. The way it's been handled is extremely negative, especially coming from our closest ally. Airlines say Canadians are increasingly booking flights to Mexico and the Caribbean for warm weather travel instead of the U.S., and their route expansions in recent months reflect those trends. How many Canadians visit Arizona? Arizona experienced record numbers of Canadian travelers in the late 2010s, peaking at 975,000 visitors in 2018. Then, Canadian tourism plummeted during the COVID-19 pandemic to a low of 257,400 visitors. Arizona began to recover from the pandemic lows over the last 2 years, with airlines resuming routes between Phoenix and Canada that were suspended during the pandemic. The most recent data from the Arizona Office of Tourism showed 852,200 Canadians visited Arizona in 2024, about 30,000 more than in 2023. Joshua Coddington, a spokesperson for the Arizona Office of Tourism, did not have Canadian visitor data for 2025 to date available. But the national outlook for Canadians' travel to the U.S. and other regional indicators, such as fewer passengers taking flights between Phoenix and Canada, suggests 2025 will be a down year. International traffic is slowing compared to past gains, said Sky Harbor spokesman Greg Roybal. We continue to work with our airline partners as Canadian tourism and business travel is very important to our region. WestJet, Air Canada, and Flair all recorded fewer passengers between Phoenix and Canada in the first 9 months of 2025. Overall travel between Canada and Sky Harbor from January to September 2025 was 645,305 passengers, down from 672,960 during the same period in 2024, according to the airport's passenger traffic data. The tallies include WestJet, Air Canada, Flair, and Porter Airlines, whose Phoenix-Toronto route launched in October 2024. The 2024 count also included the final 2 months of ultra-low-cost Lynx Air, whose Phoenix-Calgary route ended when the carrier shut down in February 2024. Here's what Sky Harbor's passenger most recent data showed. Canadians are not abandoning the U.S., but they are reducing their travel, and eventually, demand for U.S. travel will return, said Porter Airlines spokesperson Robin Van Tunenbroek, whose airline recently introduced 2 new seasonal routes between Phoenix and Canada. Why is Canadian travel important to Arizona? Canada plays a key role in Arizona's tourism and economy. Metro Phoenix's mild winter climate attracts a large number of Canadian tourists and snowbirds seeking refuge from snowy and icy winters. Arizona is one of the biggest markets for Canadian snowbirds, along with other warm weather states like Florida. Arizona welcomed 822,500 overnight visitors from Canada in 2023, the most recent year with available numbers. These visitors contributed a total of $775 million in visitor spending that year, said Coddington, the Arizona Office of Tourism spokesman. About 36% of Visa credit card spending in Arizona by international travelers during the first 3 months of 2024 came from Canadians, an AOT report showed. On average, Canadian travelers spend 9 nights at their destination, he said. Canadians who visit Arizona for 30 days or less are considered overnight visitors. Coddington's data doesn't include snowbirds, anyone who visits 31 days or more. The Canada-Arizona Business Council estimates snowbirds have a $1.4 billion economic impact in Arizona each year, separate from the economic impact of overnight visitors. Fortunately for us, many of those visitors choose to stay with us right here in Arizona and spend some portion of that money here, Coddington said. Of course, any reduction in visitors to Arizona from Canada would be felt by our state. from the airlines to hotels to transportation to restaurants to supermarkets and attractions. Airlines cut service between Canada and U.S. One way the impact is already being felt is in reductions in accessibility via air travel. Airlines have cut flights and suspended routes because of below-normal demand. United Airlines canceled a planned new route between Toronto and Los Angeles. WestJet scrapped plans for Calgary, New York City, and Edmonton, Orlando routes. Flair Airlines cut short its 2024-25 season at multiple U.S. airports, including Phoenix, where it flew to Calgary, Edmonton, and Vancouver. Staff later confirmed to the Republic that Flair would not return to Sky Harbor for the 2025-26 season. Besides Phoenix, Flair suspended service from Nashville, New York City, and Palm Springs. How the drop in Canadian tourism is affecting Sky Harbor. There were about 9% fewer scheduled seats on flights arriving in Phoenix from Canada in April 2025 compared to the start of the year, according to a study from aviation data company Visual Approach Analytics. The Republic reached out to all four Canadian carriers with service out of Sky Harbor, Flair, Air Canada, WestJet, and Porter Airlines, to find out how routes out of Phoenix are being affected by lower demand for Canadian travel to the U.S. Flair cut short the 2024-25 season for its flights between Phoenix and three Canadian cities, Calgary, Edmonton, and Vancouver. Flights to Calgary and Edmonton ended April 8th, while flights to Vancouver ended April 22nd, airline spokesperson Kim Bowie said. 2 months later, airline officials confirmed it would not be returning to Phoenix for 2025-26 after the Arizona Republic found Phoenix was no longer a selectable destination for booking flights on Flair's website. Flair began serving Sky Harbor during the 2023-24 winter season. It formerly operated seasonal flights to Canada out of Mesa Gateway Airport and Tucson International Airport, but ended service at both airports in 2023. Air Canada, Canada's flag carrier and largest airline, flies to three cities from Phoenix: Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver. A spokesperson for the airline said Canadian demand for U.S. flights remains a very fluid situation, and we are very closely monitoring events, but did not say whether routes out of Phoenix would be cut. WestJet, Canada's second largest airline, doesn't plan to suspend routes out of Phoenix, but airline spokesperson Julia Brunette did say that staff recently noticed Canadian travelers are favoring Mexico and the Caribbean over the U.S. for sun destinations. The airline remains focused on knowing where people want to go, and we will continue to fly where there is demand, Brunette said. Reciprocal visitation from both Canadian and U.S. tourists is important for the tourism industry, as it drives economic stimulus on both sides of the border. WestJet operates the most Canadian routes out of Sky Harbor, flying to Calgary, Alberta, Edmonton, Alberta, Kelowna, British Columbia, Regina, Saskatchewan, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Vancouver, and Winnipeg, Manitoba. It flew more than 520,000 passengers from Sky Harbor in 2024, the most of any Canadian airline. WestJet and its now defunct low-cost subsidiary Swoop also flew out of Mesa Gateway Airport until 2023. Low-cost carrier Porter was the first airline to announce a Canadian route network expansion out of Phoenix during Trump's second presidency, seasonal flights to Vancouver and Ottawa, Ontario. As of November, Porter has just one route out of Sky Harbor, to and from Toronto. When Porter assessed its U.S. routes, it found that while capacity was down year over year, the Phoenix-Toronto route was doing well, Van Tunenbroek said. We're adjusting our flying for where people want to go, and during the winter in Canada, that's to sun destinations, she said. What does the future look like for Canadian tourism in Arizona? While a large number of Canadian travelers and snowbirds are choosing not to visit the U.S., some are undeterred. Garnett Fry, who has wintered in Mesa with his wife for the last 11 years to escape the frigid Alberta winters, said he plans to continue wintering in Arizona in 2026. Fry drives both ways for the trip to Arizona in November and the returns home in April. Between, they fly to Alberta to visit family for the holidays. He understands why many of his fellow Canadians are choosing to go elsewhere this winter season, but he likes coming to Arizona for the weather and the camaraderie with fellow residents in the RV park community where he stays, which he estimates is populated by 20% Canadian snowbirds. "We certainly plan on returning south again," Fry said, "until health or insurance costs stop us." Ultimately, politics will determine if more of Fry's fellow citizens will join him in the States. Politics remain a deciding factor for Canadian tourism in Arizona. The future of Canadian tourism hinges on whether relations between the U.S. and Canadian governments improve enough to restore Canadians' confidence in the U.S., said Zimbalyuk. He hopes both sides will resolve their differences and tourism between Canada and the U.S. continues. "If people can start to see the governments are working together again," Zimbalyuk said, "I hope the negatives start to go away." In the fall, Canada began a marketing campaign offering welcoming messages to American visitors planning to travel to Canada to show they are ready to move on from the politics of the trade war. But it continues to be an uphill battle. In October, Trump was incensed by an advertisement produced by Ontario, Canada's regional government that depicted the late president and conservative icon Ronald Reagan speaking about the consequences of tariffs on foreign goods. The ad selectively edited five complete sentences from a 1987 radio address that Reagan gave after increasing tariffs on Japanese imports in response to Japan violating a semiconductor trade agreement. In response to the ad, Trump increased tariffs on Canadian goods by 10% and ended trade negotiations with Canada. Prime Minister Mark Carney said he apologized to Trump for the ad. Evidence suggests that while politics are discouraging Canadians from visiting the U.S., it has been a boon for at least one other warm weather destination. While the number of Canadian arrivals to the U.S. by air fell more than 30% from January to July 2025, Mexico's government stated that Canadian tourist visits to Mexico jumped nearly 12% during that same time. And that feature front page article was entitled "Snowbirds Not Headed South," and that was by Michael Salerno. And now our next top story from the Arizona Republic is entitled "It's the Same Textbook, Why Is the Content Different?" This is by Alexandra Hartle. Two school districts in the Phoenix area are using a textbook that outwardly appears identical, but contains divergent lessons on recent history. Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn last summer held a news conference condemning the Scottsdale Unified School District for adopting a textbook that he said taught students woke lessons, including the portrayal of police and the Black Lives Matter movement. At the news conference, Horn said Peoria Unified adopted the same textbook, Savvis Learning Company's U.S. History Interactive High School curriculum, but with all the woke references removed. Peoria Unified's approach to the textbook exemplifies how simple it has become to modify the building blocks of students' lessons, and how even though students in different school districts could be using a textbook with the same title, the content inside could be very different. The differences between the curricula at Peoria Unified and Scottsdale Unified ultimately come down to their respective school boards. Horn said his office develops state standards, which are then approved by the State Board of Education. It's then up to the districts to adopt a curriculum that meets those standards. If schools receive adequate letter grades and meet the standards, they won't be at risk of being taken over by the state, Horn said. Different standards exist for each subject at each grade level. For example, history and social studies standards for grades 6 to 8 require students to be able to develop and defend evidence-based arguments and utilize multiple perspectives for comprehensive explanation among other standards. Scottsdale Unified unflinching in face of criticism. Horn claimed that adopting the textbook used in Scottsdale Unified violated the Trump administration's guidance about diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and initiatives, even though that guidance had been blocked by several federal judges. As of early 2026, the executive order remains in limbo. After the federal guidance was announced, the Trump administration and Horn asked school districts to sign a certification form confirming that they would not employ diversity, equity, and inclusion policies that violated federal law. Scottsdale Unified, along with Peoria Unified School District, signed the certification form, as did most Arizona school districts. Despite Horn's news conference, Scottsdale Unified did not budge. The district said that Horn's claims were untrue. There are no facts that have been presented that would indicate Scottsdale Unified School District is out of compliance with any state or federal statute. We signed the attestation and stand by it. SUSD is not operating any illegal DEI programs, said district spokesperson Christine Harrington in a written statement in June. The district creates an equitable environment where everyone is respected, is treated with dignity, and has a strong sense of belonging, the statement concluded. A lesson on the Black Lives Matter movement is part of a section of the textbook analyzing 21st century presidencies. It's in a portion of the book about Barack Obama's presidency and teaches students about the killing of Trayvon Martin in 2012, as well as Eric Garner, Michael Brown, and Tamir Rice in 2014. It then teaches students about Obama's response to the growing movement against police violence against Black people. In the teacher edition of the textbook, teachers are prompted to ask students why some Americans perceive the killings as an injustice and also why some Americans criticize the Black Lives Matter movement. It also prompts teachers to discuss why taking a knee during the national anthem was controversial, in reference to the gesture popularized by football player Colin Kaepernick. The lesson also asks students to examine the role of social media in the Black Lives Matter movement and draw parallels with the civil rights movement. Peoria Unified's approach exemplifies ease of modifications. The New Jersey-based company that provided textbooks for both districts, Savvis Learning Company, has offices located in Arizona. The textbook in question is for history classes and teaches students about historical events, including those of the 21st century. Peoria Unified is adopting a paperless curriculum, meaning students will primarily use digital textbooks. The district has recently been a politically conservative district due to its school board. Board President Heather Rooks, in particular, is known for her conservative views. Peoria Unified took out all of the lessons that could be considered controversial, including the Black Lives Matter lesson mentioned by Horn. Peoria Unified is modifying textbooks in two ways. First, according to district documents, the publisher agreed to remove any references to social-emotional learning from teacher textbooks. The Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning describes social and emotional learning as the process that helps youth develop knowledge and skills to manage their emotions and achieve personal goals. It also helps them establish and maintain relationships and show empathy for others, helping to advance educational equity. Rook said the district decided to move social-emotional learning references from the teacher version of the textbook because they don't need to be in history textbooks that discuss government, history, and current events. Rook said parents were also concerned about whose values are being taught with social-emotional learning since different families have different values. In addition to removing social and emotional learning from teachers' books, Chief Academic Success Officer Teresa Hernandez said the district followed a separate process involving different textbook committees to flag any controversial topics that aren't necessary to meet state standards. Hernandez said this district isn't aiming to prevent teachers from discussing certain topics, but to eliminate topics that don't help the district meet state standards. Some of those topics include the Black Lives Matter lesson, as well as any lessons related to the negative portrayal of police and gender identity. The district is also working to create a platform on the district website that will allow parents to see what their children are learning in school in real time, in an effort to get parents more involved in their children's education. Hernandez said the district is also communicating with teachers to ensure the lesson sequence makes sense and to determine whether any modification should be made, which is ongoing. At a June governing board meeting, Hernandez said the textbook selection committee evaluated every page of the Savvis textbook to ensure that no content is divisive, misaligned with governing board values, or factually questionable according to district documents. Hernandez said Black Lives Matter, gender identity, and negative portrayal of police were among the topics flagged for review. The district, including teachers, will then assess whether the curriculum will still meet standards even with some content omitted. Some content could be flagged as prohibited, and some could fall into a category that requires caution in accordance with governing board policy. Prohibited content means that teachers will be unable to discuss the topics in the classroom and should instead direct students to have those conversations at home. In November, Horn said Scottsdale Unified had been reported to the federal government. Horn said that all schools that are still implementing DEI will be reported to the federal government, and the state will comply if asked to revoke their federal funding. Horn said other companies have also offered to make adjustments to get rid of woke references, such as Character Counts, which is another online education program that aims to combat youth violence. And that article is entitled, It's the Same Textbook, Why is the Content Different? And that was by Alexandra Hartle. Moving on to articles from Valiant State News, this one is entitled, Aldi Continues Its Expansion in Metro Phoenix. This is by Ray Covarrubias, Jr. Aldi bought and is cleared to develop roughly 3 acres of vacant land at the southeast corner of Power and Elliott Roads in Mesa as the discount grocer continues to expand across Metro Phoenix. The Germany-based grocery chain paid $2.4 million in cash for the property in late December, according to an affidavit of property value filed with Maricopa County a month after Mesa issued building permits for the site, according to city records and a city spokesperson, Kevin Christopher. In December, Mesa also reviewed Aldi plans for another store at Greenfield Road and Main Street, following the company's purchase of a former 99-cents-only store building. Under the same name, the new Aldi will be part of Avalon Ranch, a 14-acre commercial development, according to city planning documents filed with Mesa. Aldi will be the anchor tenant within the ground-up development, but the plan also includes EOS Fitness, McDonald's, Taco Bell, 7-Eleven, Valvoline Instant Oil Change, and other commercial pads, according to the documents. The plans show a single-story grocery store with loading areas, screened rooftop equipment, and standard exterior signage. The site is zoned limited commercial and designated for mixed-use activity under Mesa's General Plan 2040. The permits have been issued and the project is awaiting inspections, Christopher said. The city has not released a construction start date or opening timeline. Sean Eddy, Regional Vice President of Aldi USA, said the Power and Elliott location was expected to open by the end of 2026. We are excited to confirm we are making headway on 2 new stores in Mesa, Eddy said in a statement. There are currently 15 Aldi locations open across Metro Phoenix. Eddy said the Aldi location on northeast corner of Gilbert Road and Southern Avenue was expected to open this spring. And that article is entitled, Aldi Continues Its Expansion in Metro Phoenix, and that was by Ray Covarrubias, Jr. We're approximately 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, January 11th, 2026. Continuing with Valiant State News, this article is entitled, Maricopa County Enacts Plan to Aid Animal Shelters. This is by John Leos. The Maricopa County Animal Care and Control Department is creating a nonprofit partner organization to help raise money before millions in federal funding dries up this year. The Maricopa County Board of Supervisors voted in December to allocate an extra $50,000 in donations to the county's animal care department to help create a nonprofit organization, the Friends of Animal Care and Control. The department will now have access to up to $350,000 from the county's animal care donation fund, which they can use to help pay for startup costs for the organization, such as hiring an executive director and paying legal and administrative costs. The Friends of Animal Care and Control will be a completely separate entity from the county department, and the organization is expected to be self-sustaining after its first year of operation. Other municipal shelter systems have similar nonprofit support, like the Friends of Pima Animal Care Center organization that serves the Tucson area and Pima County. Providing a funding source for county animal shelters beyond what's allocated in the general fund not only enables better care for animals in need, but it also saves taxpayer money. It's a win-win for both our two- and four-legged residents, said Thomas Galvan, chairman of the county's Board of Supervisors, in a news release. Historically, Maricopa County shelters have been plagued with financial troubles, relying heavily on taxpayer dollars to balance its budget. Reporting from the Republic in 2019 also revealed hostile workplace conditions and controversial animal transport practices under a director that resigned months later. With the creation of a nonprofit arm, the county is exploring a new source of sustainable funding for the department and homeless pet population as it continues renovating its shelter facilities. New funding source will help replace federal dollars. County officials said the nonprofit's role will be philanthropic and not involved in day-to-day shelter operations. The organization will help the department raise money for communities' activities not required by law, like spay-neuter events, microchipping clinics, and adoption fee sponsorships through direct donations and grants. In recent years, many of these activities were supported by federal funding through the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, which will end in 2026. In the past 4 years, Maricopa County Animal Care and Control has received over $4.5 million from such sources. While we are able to accept donations currently, the Friends of Animal Care and Control will allow Maricopa County Animal Care and Control to work more closely with donors, and it will provide opportunities for grants that are only available to nonprofits, said Debbie McKnight, director of Maricopa County Animal Care and Control, in a news release. This new nonprofit will have a singular goal, funding programs and services that directly or indirectly serve the homeless pet population, said McKnight. County officials are planning to launch the Friends of Animal Care and Control nonprofit organization by the end of 2026. New West Valley shelter expected to break ground in 2026. Construction is set to begin on a new animal shelter in Glendale this year that will replace the county's West Valley shelter in Phoenix. Spanning over 93,000 square feet, the new shelter will be larger than the existing facility, adding over 200 kennels for a total capacity of 630 kennels. The facility will be located off Loop 101 near Glen Harbor Boulevard and Northern Avenue. County officials say the new location will be more accessible to communities in the northern and western Phoenix metro areas, with the ultimate goal of increasing shelter turnover through the adoptions of pets, primarily dogs. It is very customer-focused as well as dog-focused, said Kim Powell, a spokesperson for Maricopa County Animal Care and Control. We want people to walk into the shelter and feel welcome, feel comfortable, and they're going to see all the amazing dogs that we have. It's really exciting, said Powell. In 2024, the county opened a $43 million East Valley shelter in Mesa, upgrading from a smaller facility that was originally planned as a rabies vaccination site. After the new shelter is completed, the old West Valley shelter in Phoenix will be converted into a facility for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office MASH unit, which rehabilitates abused and neglected animals. MASH stands for Maricopa Animal Safe Haven. In 2025, the county took in over 17,500 animals and adopted out over 11,500. Since 2017, the county shelters have received a no-kill designation from the Best Friends Animal Society, a leading national animal welfare organization, for saving over 90% of the animals that enter their care. Maricopa is expected to break ground on the new Glendale facility around spring, summer of 2026 and open in summer 2028. And that article was entitled, Maricopa County Enacts Plan to Aid Animal Shelters, and that was by John Leos. This next article is entitled, Why Avelo Deportation-Related Flights in Arizona Will End. This is by Daniel Gonzalez. Avelo Airlines will stop flying deportation-related flights out of the Mesa Gateway Airport on January 27th, 8 months after the ultra-low-cost carrier began transporting immigration detainees as part of the Trump administration's escalating mass deportation agenda. The Houston-based airline said ending the deportation-related flights from Mesa Gateway Airport was part of a streamlining of operations to focus on service at four cities after receiving an infusion of capital to grow the company over the long term. Avelo's decision to transport immigration detainees as part of a government contract, in addition to commercial passenger flights, triggered a backlash from immigrant rights groups who accused the fledgling carrier of shoring up revenues by cashing in on the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign. More than 40,000 people signed a Change.org petition pledging to boycott the carrier until the airline stopped carrying out deportation-related flights under a contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. New Haven Mayor Justin Ehlicker and Connecticut Attorney General William Tong also criticized Avelo Airlines for assisting with the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda while receiving government support in Connecticut. New Haven is one of Avelo's bases. Avelo spokeswoman Courtney Goff said the airline will close its operation at Mesa Gateway Airport on January 27th and will conclude all participation in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security charter program. The program provided short-term benefits, but ultimately did not deliver enough consistent or predictable revenue to overcome its operational complexity and costs, Goff said in a written statement. The airline was not affected by the boycott, Goff said. We did not see an impact regarding customers choosing to fly, Goff said. She said Avelo in 2025 carried a record 2.6 million customers on scheduled commercial service, 11% higher than in 2024, with minimal seat growth. She also said Avelo's planes were more full in 2025 than in 2024. With our unique combination of everyday low fares, easy and convenient to use base airports, delivered with leading reliability, it is no surprise that customers continue to embrace us, Goff said. The Department of Homeland Security announced in December that it had signed a contract to purchase six Boeing 737 planes for deportations, the Washington Post said. The $140 million purchase was made after the Department of Homeland Security received $170 billion in additional funding to ramp up immigration enforcement, detention, and removals through H.R. 1, the One Big Beautiful Bill budget legislation signed into law in July. Avelo Airlines has been the main airline operating deportation-related flights out of Mesa Gateway Airport, said Savitri Arvi, Director of Research and Analysis and Refugee Protection at Human Rights First, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that promotes human rights and the rule of law. Avelo carried out a total of 478 deportation-related flights from May to December 31st, according to data collected by ICE Flight Monitor, which tracks ICE-related flights and is based at Human Rights First. The 478 flights included 398 shuffle flights transporting immigration detainees to and from Arizona to other states, 16 removal flights, and 64 removal-related flights, according to the ICE Flight Monitor data. Launched in 2021, Avelo was the only commercial passenger carrier operating deportation flights under government contracts, she said. What is significant about Avelo is that it is the only airline carrier that sells retail tickets to travelers that has decided to operate as a subcontractor for ICE Air. And we saw widespread pushback across the country from protesters, but also local government officials, RV said. So it's quite notable that Avelo is ending their contract after only 9 months. Several other charter airlines operate deportation-related flights out of Mesa Gateway Airport under government contracts. Tulsa-based Omni Air International, Kansas City-based Eastern Airlines and subsidiary Eastern Air Express, Miami-based Global X, and Colorado-based Key Lime Air, RV said. In total, 796 deportation-related flights were carried out from Mesa Gateway Airport in 2025, according to ICE Flight Monitor data. And that article is entitled, Why Avelo Deportation-Related Flights in Arizona Will End. And that was by Daniel Gonzalez. In the faces of Arizona section of the Republic, we have this article entitled, This Museum is Evolving, Meet the Man Behind It. This is by Meredith G. White. Dan Finley may have begun his career as a county executive in Wisconsin, but he's now the executive director of the newly renamed Sigler Western Museum in Wickenburg. So, how does one go from an elected official to museum director? For Finley, it was a matter of the heart. When Finley learned a local Milwaukee museum was experiencing serious financial troubles, he knew he needed to help. They needed someone to come in and run the museum, Finley said. And I felt a little tap from the good Lord on my shoulder saying, I need you over there. And that's exactly what Finley did. When Finley told his wife he was being called to help the museum in peril, she raised a good question. What do you know about museums? Finley believes that there are a lot of similarities between the two jobs, however. First off, government and nonprofits are both nonprofits, so that's number one. There's not a profit motive in either one, Finley explained. But the jobs are very much similar in terms of working with budgets, meeting the public, marketing, HR issues, even fundraising. So they're really very similar, and it just was a very easy fit for me to slide over into the museum world, especially as a person with a passion for history. While Finley may have gone into a government role, he's always considered himself a historian at heart. In fact, Finley is a self-proclaimed expert on U.S. presidential history and has read at least one biography on every U.S. president. History is wonderful. We can learn all about how we got to where we are today, and certainly lessons learned from the past that we can hopefully apply to the future and make the world better for all of us, Finley said. And Finley believes that American Western history is particularly unique. There's simply no other country on earth where there was this migration across it, Finley said. In Western history, it's always been referred to as manifest destiny, and that's never happened anywhere, so it's a great story. The Sigler Western Museum not only received a new name in 2025, but also a $20 million donation that will be used to finance a new art museum and pavilion located across the street from the existing location. And Finley has big plans for the 27,000-square-foot facility. Our new art museum building will allow us to not only show more of our Western art, which we think is a great way to tell the stories of the West, but that will open up our current building exclusively for Western history stories, and as a result, we're going to be really on the cutting edge of sharing all those diverse stories of the West, Finley said. And that article is entitled, This Museum is Evolving, Meet the Man Behind It, and that was by Meredith G. White. Now we're going to turn to world and national news with articles from USA Today with two front page articles. The first is on protests in Minneapolis, and the second is on Denmark and Greenland. The first article is entitled Thousands Protest in Minneapolis. The subtitle is Over 1,000 ICE Out Rallies Planned Across U.S. This is by Renee Hickman, Steve Gorman, and Nathan Lane. Tens of thousands of people marched through Minneapolis on January 10th to decry the fatal shooting of a woman by U.S. immigration agent, part of more than 1,000 rallies planned nationwide this weekend against the federal government's deportation drive. The massive turnout in Minneapolis, despite a whipping cold wind, underscores how the fatal shooting of 37-year-old Renee Good by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer on January 7th has struck a chord, fueling protests in major cities and some towns. Minnesota's Democratic leaders and the administration of President Donald Trump, a Republican, have offered starkly different accounts of the incident. Led by a team of indigenous Mexican dancers, demonstrators in Minneapolis, which has a metropolitan population of 3.8 million, marched toward the residential street where Good was shot in her car. The boisterous crowd, which the Minneapolis Police Department estimated in the tens of thousands, chanted Good's name and slogans such as "Abolish ICE" and "No justice, no peace, get ICE off our streets." "I'm insanely angry, completely heartbroken and devastated, and then just like longing and hoping that things get better," Ellison Montgomery, a 30-year-old protester, told Reuters. Minnesota officials have called the shooting unjustified, pointing to bystander video they say showed Good's vehicle turning away from the agent as he fired. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE, has maintained that the agent acted in self-defense because Good, a volunteer in a community network that monitors and records ICE operations in Minneapolis, drove forward in the direction of the agent who then shot her after another agent had approached the driver's side and told her to get out of the car. The shooting came soon after some 2,000 federal officers were dispatched to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area in what DHS has called its largest operation ever, deepening a rift between the administration and Democratic leaders in the state. Federal-state tensions escalated further on January 8th, when a U.S. Border Patrol agent in Portland, Oregon, shot and wounded a man and woman in their car after an attempted vehicle stop. Using language similar to its description of the Minneapolis incident, DHS said the driver had tried to weaponize his vehicle and run over agents. The two DHS-related shootings prompted a coalition of progressive and civil rights groups, including Indivisible and the American Civil Liberties Union, to plan more than 1,000 events under the banner "ICE Out for Good" on January 10th to 11th. The rallies have been scheduled to end before nightfall to minimize the potential for violence. In Philadelphia, protesters chanted "ICE has got to go" and "No fascist USA" as they marched from City Hall to a rally outside a federal detention facility, according to the local ABC affiliate. In Manhattan, several hundred people carried anti-ICE signs as they walked past an immigration court where agents have arrested migrants following their hearings. "We demand justice for Renee, ICE out of our communities, and action from our elected leaders. Enough is enough," said Lee Greenberg, co-executive director of Indivisible. Minnesota became a major flashpoint in the administration's efforts to deport millions of immigrants before the Good shooting, with Trump criticizing its Democratic leaders amid a massive welfare fraud scandal involving some members of the large Somali-American community there. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, a Democrat who has been critical of immigration agents in the shooting, told a press conference earlier on January 10th that the demonstrations have remained mostly peaceful and that anyone damaging property or engaging in unlawful activity would be arrested by police. "We will not counter Donald Trump's chaos with our own brand of chaos," Frey said. "He wants us to take the bait." More than 200 law enforcement officers were deployed January 9th to control protests that led to $6,000 in damage at the Depot Renaissance Hotel and failed attempts by some demonstrators to enter the Hilton Canopy Hotel, believed to house ICE agents, the city of Minneapolis said in a statement. Police Chief Brian O'Hara said some in the crowd scrawled graffiti and damaged windows at the Depot Renaissance Hotel. He said the gathering at the Hilton Canopy Hotel began as a noise protest, but escalated as more than 1,000 demonstrators converged on the site, leading to 29 arrests. "We initiated a plan and took our time to de-escalate the situation, issued multiple warnings, declaring an unlawful assembly, and ultimately then began to move in and disperse the crowd, O'Hara said. Three Minnesota congressional Democrats showed up at a regional ICE facility near Minneapolis on January 10th, but were denied access. Legislators called the denial illegal. DHS spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin said policies require members of Congress to notify ICE at least 7 days in advance of visits. And that article is entitled Thousands Protest in Minneapolis. That was by Renee Hickman, Steve Gorman, and Nathan Lane. Our second front page article from USA Today is entitled Denmark Finds Itself in a Dilemma with Greenland. The subtitle is Country Defends Territory Already on Its Way Out. This is by Jacob Granholdt Peterson and Steen Jacobsen. When U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio meets his Danish and Greenlandic counterparts, Denmark will be defending a territory that has been moving steadily toward independence since 1979. President Donald Trump's threats to seize Greenland have triggered a wave of European solidarity with Denmark. But the crisis has exposed an uncomfortable reality. Denmark is rallying support to protect a territory whose population wants independence and whose largest opposition party now wants to bypass Copenhagen and negotiate directly with Washington. Denmark risks exhausting its foreign policy capital to secure Greenland, only to watch it walk away afterwards, said Mikkel Vedby Rasmussen, a political science professor at University of Copenhagen. Denmark cannot let Greenland go without losing its geopolitical relevance in the Arctic territory, strategically located between Europe and North America, and a critical site for the U.S. ballistic missile defense system. Yet it may ultimately have nothing to show for its efforts if Greenlanders choose independence or strike their own deal with Washington. The stakes extend beyond Denmark's national interests. European allies have rallied behind Denmark not just out of solidarity, but because giving up Greenland would set a dangerous precedent that could embolden other powers to pursue territorial claims against smaller nations, upending the post-1945 world order. Denmark's foreign ministry declined to comment, but referred to joint remarks by Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen and Greenlandic Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen on December 22nd. National borders and the sovereignty of states are rooted in international law, the two leaders said. They are fundamental principles. You cannot annex another country. Greenland belongs to Greenlanders. Frederiksen said, if the U.S. chooses to attack another NATO country, everything stops, including NATO and the security the alliance has provided since World War II. For now, the Trump administration says all options are on the table, including buying the territory or taking it by force. Rasmussen said any discussion of whether holding on to Greenland is worth the cost has been drowned out by outrage at Trump's threats. It is not part of the political debate in Denmark. I fear we have gone into patriotic overdrive, he said. During the Cold War, Greenland's strategic location gave Denmark outsized influence in Washington and allowed it to maintain lower defense spending that would otherwise be expected of a NATO ally. This became known as the Greenland card, according to a 2017 report by the University of Copenhagen Center for Military Studies. But Greenland's aspirations for self-determination have been brewing since the former colony got greater autonomy and its own parliament in 1979. A 2009 agreement explicitly recognized Greenlanders' right to independence if they choose. All Greenlandic parties say they want independence, but differ on how and when to achieve it. Trump's pressure has accelerated a timeline that was already in motion, forcing Copenhagen to spend political capital and financial resources on a relationship with an increasingly uncertain endpoint. How much should we fight for someone who doesn't really care about us, Joachim B. Olsen, a political commentator and former Danish lawmaker, told Reuters. Copenhagen provides an annual block grant of roughly $610 million to Greenland's economy, which is near stagnation with GDP growth of just 0.2% in 2025. The central bank estimates an annual financing gap of approximately $124 million to make public finances sustainable. Denmark also covers police, the justice system, and defense, bringing total annual spending to just under $1 billion. In addition, Copenhagen last year announced a $6.54 billion Arctic defense package in response to U.S. criticism that Denmark has not done enough to protect Greenland. Some reject framing the relationship in transactional terms, pointing to Denmark's legal and moral obligations under international law and centuries of shared history. We're talking about family relations, long history of relations before Denmark and Greenland, said Mark Jacobson, an associate professor at the Royal Danish Defense College. So this is much more. It's not just about defense and economy. It's about feelings. It's about culture. Prime Minister Frederiksen faces a difficult balancing act, said Serafima Andreeva, researcher at Oslo-based Fridtjof Nansen Institute. For now, Denmark has little choice but to stand firm to maintain its diplomatic credibility, but in doing so risks the relationship with the United States at a time when Russia is an accelerating threat and being on the U.S.'s bad side is no good for anyone in the West. Frederiksen also faces an election this year, though Greenland has not been a major theme. I don't understand why we have to cling to this community with Greenland when they so badly want out of it, Lone Frank, a Danish science writer and broadcaster, told Reuters. To be completely honest, Greenland doesn't inspire any sense of belonging in me. And that article's entitled, Denmark Finds Itself in a Dilemma with Greenland, and that was by Jacob Granholdt Petersen and Steen Jacobson. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, January 11th, 2026. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on-demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.